Side 8. Disclosure. By Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 336. He hesitated. You know, women always think that men don't know what's going on. There's this whole idea that men can't find the place, they don't know what to do, all that stuff. How men are stupid about sex.
I don't think you're stupid. What does a cough mean?
A cough means you're not involved. She raised her eyebrows.
That seems a little extreme.
It's just a fact.
I don't know. My husband has bronchitis. He coughs all the time.
Not at the last moment he doesn't. She paused, thinking about it.
Well, he certainly does right afterward. He breaks out in a fit of coughing. We always laugh about how he does that.
Right after is different. But at the moment, right in the intense moment, I'm telling you, nobody coughs.
More images flashed through his mind. Her cheeks turn red, her neck is blotchy, or her upper chest. Nipples no longer hard. They were hard at first, but not now. The eyes get dark, sometimes purple below. Lips swollen, breathing changes. Sudden surging heat. Shift in the hips, shifting rhythm. Tension, but something else, something liquid. Forehead frowning. Wincing, biting. So many different ways, but...
Nobody coughs, he said again.
And then he felt a kind of sudden embarrassment and pulled his plate back and took a bite of pasta. He wanted a reason not to say more, because he had the feeling that he had overstepped the rules, that there was still this area, this kind of knowledge, this awareness that everyone pretended didn't exist. Fernandez was staring at him curiously.
Did you read about this somewhere?
He shook his head, chewing.
Do men discuss it? Things like this?
He shook his head, no.
Women do.
I know. He swallowed. But anyway, she coughed, and that was why I stopped. She wasn't involved, and I was very angry about it, I guess. I mean, she was lying there panting and moaning, but she was really uninvolved, and I felt...
Exploited?
Something like that. Manipulated. Sometimes I think maybe if she hadn't coughed right then. Sanders shrugged.
Maybe I should ask her,
Fernandez said, nodding her head in Meredith's direction. Sanders looked up and saw that she was coming over to their table.
Oh, hell. Calmly, calmly, everything's fine.
Meredith came over, a big smile on her face.
Hello, Louise. Hello, Tom.
Sanders started to get up.
Don't get up, Tom, please.
She rested her hand on his shoulder, gave it a little squeeze.
I just came by for a moment.
She was smiling radiantly. She looked exactly like the confident boss, stopping to say hello to a couple of colleagues. Back at her table, Sanders saw Garvin paying the bill.
He wondered if he would come over, too.
Louise, I just wanted to say no hard feelings, Meredith said. Everybody had a job to do. I understand that, and I think it served a purpose, clearing the air. I just hope we can go on productively from here.
Meredith was standing behind Sanders's chair as she talked. He had to twist his head and crane his neck to look at her. Fernandez said,
Don't you want to sit down? Well, maybe for a minute.
Sanders stood to get her a chair. He was thinking that to the Conley people, all this would look exactly right. The boss not wanting to intrude, waiting to be pressed by her co-workers to join them. As he brought the chair, he glanced over and saw that Nichols was looking at them, peering over his glasses.
So was young Conley.
Meredith sat down. Sanders pushed the chair in for her.
You want anything?
Fernandez said solicitously.
I just finished, thanks. Coffee? Anything? I'm fine, thanks.
Sanders sat down. Meredith leaned forward.
Bob's been telling me about his plans to take this division public. It's very exciting. It looks like full speed ahead.
Sanders watched her with astonishment.
Now, Bob has a list of names for the new company when we spin it off next year. See how these sound to you. Speed Corps, Speedstar, Prime Corps, Taliesin, and Tensor. I think Speed Corps makes racing parts for stock cars. Speed Star is right on the money. but maybe too right on. Crime Corps sounds like a mutual fund. How about Taliesin or Tensor?
Tensor is a lamp, Hernandez said.
Okay, but Taliesin is pretty good, I think.
The Apple-IBM joint venture is called Taligence, Sanders said.
Oh, you're right. Too close. How about Microdyne? That's not bad. Or ADG, for Advanced Data Graphics. Do either of those work, do you think?
Microdyne is okay.
I thought so, too. And there was one more. Anodyne.
That's a painkiller, Fernandez said.
What is?
An anodyne is a painkiller, a narcotic.
Oh, forget that. Last one, Sinstar.
Sounds like a drug company.
Yeah, it does. But we've got a year to come up with a better one, and Microdyne isn't bad, to start. Sort of combining micro with dynamo. Good images, don't you think?
Before they could answer, she pushed her chair back.
I've got to go, but I thought you'd like to hear the thinking.
Thanks for your input. Good night, Louise.
And Tom, I'll see you tomorrow.
She shook hands with them both and crossed the room to Garvin. Together, she and Garvin went over to the Conley table to say hello. Sanders stared at her.
Good images, he repeated.
Christ, she's talking about names for a company, but she doesn't even know what the company is.
It was quite a show.
Sure, Sanders said. She's all show. But it had nothing to do with us. It's for them. He nodded toward the Conley white people sitting across the restaurant. Garvin was shaking hands all around, and Meredith was talking to Jim Daly. Daly made a joke, and she laughed, throwing her head back, showing her long neck. The only reason she talked to us was so that when I get fired tomorrow, she won't be seen as having planned it. Fernandez was paying the bill.
You want to go? She said.
I still have some things to check.
Really?
What do you have to check?
Alan may have gotten something more for us. There's a possibility.
At the Conley table, Garvin was saying goodbye. He gave a final wave, then crossed the room to talk to Carmine. Meredith remained at the Conley white table. She was standing behind John Conley, with her hands resting on his shoulders, while she talked to Daly and Ed Nichols. Ed Nichols said something, peering over his glasses, and Meredith laughed and came around to look over his shoulder at a sheet of figures he was holding. Her head was very close to Nichols. She nodded, talked, pointed to the sheet.
You're checking the wrong company.
Sanders stared at Meredith, smiling and joking with the three men from Conley White.
What had Phil Blackburn said to him yesterday?
The thing is, Tom, Meredith Johnson is very well connected in this company. She has impressed a lot of important people.
Like Garvin.
Not only Garvin. Meredith has built a power base in several areas.
Conley White?
Yes, there too.
Alongside him, Fernandez stood up. Sanders stood and said,
You know what, Louise?
What?
We've been checking the wrong company.
Fernandez frowned, then looked over at the Conley White table. Meredith was nodding with Ed Nichols and pointing with one hand, her other hand flat on the table for balance. Her fingers were touching Ed Nichols. He was peering at the sheets of data over his glasses.
Stupid glasses, Sanders said.
No wonder Meredith wouldn't press harassment charges against him. It would have been too embarrassing for her relationship with Ed Nichols. And no wonder Garvin wouldn't fire her. It made perfect sense. Nichols was already uneasy about the merger. His affair with Meredith might be all that was holding it in place. Fernandez sighed.
You think so?
Nichols?
Yeah, why not?
Fernandez shook her head.
Even if it's true, it doesn't help us. They can argue paramour preference. They can argue lots of things. If there's even an argument that needs to be made. This isn't the first merger made in the sack, you know. I say forget it.
You mean to tell me, he said, that there's nothing improper with her having an affair with someone at Conley White and being promoted as a result?
Nothing at all, at least not in the strict legal sense. So forget it.
Suddenly he remembered what Kaplan had said.
She was looking in the wrong direction when they fired her.
I'm tired, he said.
We all are. They look tired, too.
Across the room, the meeting was breaking up. Papers were being put back into briefcases. Meredith and Garvin were chatting with them. They all started leaving. Garvin shook hands with Carmine, who opened the front door for his departing guests.
And then it happened.
There was the sudden harsh glare of quartz lights shining in from the street outside. The group huddled together, trapped in the light. They cast long shadows back into the restaurant.
What's going on? Fernandez said.
Sanders turned to look, but already the group was ducking back inside, closing the door. There was a moment of sudden chaos. They heard Garvin say, "God damn it," and spin to Blackburn. Blackburn stood, a stricken look on his face, and rushed over to Garvin. Garvin was shifting from foot to foot. He was simultaneously trying to reassure the Conley white people and chew out Blackburn. Sanders went over.
"Everything okay?"
"It's the goddamned press," Garvin said. "KSEA-TV is out there."
"This is an outrage," Meredith said.
"They're asking about some harassment suit," Garvin said, looking darkly at Sanders. Sanders shrugged.
"I'll speak to them," Blackburn said. "This is just ridiculous."
"I'll say it's ridiculous," Garvin said. "It's an outrage is what it is." Everyone seemed to be talking at once, agreeing that it was an outrage. But Sanders saw that Nichols looked shaken. Now Meredith was leading them out of the restaurant the back way onto the terrace. Blackburn went out the front into the harsh lights. He held up his hands like a man being arrested. Then the door closed. Nichols was saying,
"Not good, not good."
"Don't worry, I know the news director over there," Garvin was saying. "I'll put this one away." Jim Daly said something about how the merger ought to be confidential. "Don't worry," Garvin said grimly. "It's going to be confidential as hell by the time I get through." Then they were gone, out the back door, into the night. Sanders went back to the table where Fernandez was waiting.
"A little excitement," Fernandez said calmly.
"More than a little," Sanders said. He glanced across the room at Stephanie Kaplan, still having dinner with her son. The young man was talking, gesturing with his hands, but Kaplan was staring fixedly at the back door where the Conley white people had departed. She had a curious expression on her face. Then, after a moment, she turned back and resumed her conversation with her son. The evening was black, damp, and unpleasant. He shivered as he walked back to his office with Fernandez.
How did a television crew get the story?
Probably from Walsh, Fernandez said. But maybe another way. It's really a small town. Anyway, never mind that. You've got to prepare for the meeting tomorrow.
I've been trying to forget that.
Yeah, well, don't. Ahead they saw Pioneer Square, with windows in the building still brightly lit. Many of the companies here had business with Japan and stayed open to overlap with the first hours of the day in Tokyo.
You know, Fernandez said, watching her with those men, I noticed how cool she was.
Yes, Meredith is cool.
Very controlled.
Yes, she is.
So why did she approach you so overtly, and on her first day, what was the rush?
What is the problem she is trying to solve? Max had said. Now Fernandez was asking the same thing. Everyone seemed to understand except Sanders. You're not a victim. So solve it, he thought. Get to work.
He remembered the conversation when Meredith and Blackburn were leaving the conference room.
It should be quite smooth and impersonal. After all, you have the facts on your side. He's clearly incompetent. He still can't get into the database?
No, he's locked out of the system.
And there's no way he can get into Conley White's system?
No way in hell, Meredith.
They were right, of course. He couldn't get into the system. But what difference would it make if he could?
Solve the problem, Max had said. Do what you do best.
Solve the problem.
Hell,
Sanders said.
It'll come, Fernandez said.
It was 9:30. On the fourth floor, cleaning crews worked in the central partition area. Sanders went into his office with Fernandez. He didn't really know why they were going there. There wasn't anything he could think to do now. Fernandez said,
Let me talk to Alan. He might have something.
She sat down and began to dial. Sanders sat behind his desk and stared at the monitor. On the screen, his email message read,
"You're still checking the wrong company. A friend."
"I don't see how," he said, looking at the screen. He felt irritable, playing with a puzzle that everyone could solve except him.
Fernandez said, "Alan, Louise, what have you got?" "Is that..." "Well, that's very disappointing, Alan." "No, I don't know now."
"If you can, yes.
When would you be seeing her?"
"All right.
Whatever you can."
She hung up.
"No luck tonight."
"But we've only got tonight."
"Yes."
Sanders stared at the message on the computer screen. Somebody inside the company was trying to help him, telling him he was checking the wrong company. The message seemed to imply that there was a way for him to check the other company. And presumably, whoever knew enough to send this message also knew that Sanders had been cut out of the Digicom system, his privileges revoked.
What could he do?
Nothing. Fernandez said,
"Who do you think this a friend is?"
"I don't know."
"Suppose you had to guess."
"I don't know."
"What comes into your mind?" she said.
He considered the possibility that a friend was Mary Ann Hunter. But Mary Ann wasn't really a technical person. Her strength was marketing. She wasn't likely to be sending routed messages over the Internet. She probably didn't know what the Internet was. So, not Mary Ann. And not Mark Lewin. Lewin was furious at him. Don Cherry? Sanders paused, considering that. In a way, this was just like Cherry. But the only time that Sanders had seen him since this began, Cherry had been distinctly unfriendly. Not Cherry. Then who else could it be? Those were the only people with executive SysOp access in Seattle. Hunter, Lewin, Cherry. A short list. Stephanie Kaplan? Unlikely. At heart, Kaplan was plotting and unimaginative, and she didn't know enough about computers to do this. Was it somebody outside the company? It could be Gary Bosak, he thought. Gary probably felt guilty about having turned his back on Sanders. And Gary had a hacker's devious instincts and a hacker's sense of humor. It might very well be Gary, but it still didn't do Sanders any good.
"You were always good at technical problems. That was always your strength."
He pulled out the Twinkle CD-ROM drive, still in plastic. Why would they want it wrapped that way? Never mind, he thought. Stay focused. There was something wrong with the drive. If he knew what, he would have the answer. Who would know? Wrapped in plastic. It was something to do with the production line. It must be. He fumbled with the material on his desk and found the DAT cartridge. He inserted it into the machine. It came up showing his conversation with Arthur Kahn. Kahn was on one side of the screen, Sanders on the other. Behind Arthur, the brightly lit assembly line beneath banks of fluorescent lights. Kahn coughed and rubbed his chin.
"Hello, Tom. How are you?"
"I'm fine, Arthur," he said.
"Well, good. I'm sorry about the new organization."
But Sanders wasn't listening to the conversation. He was looking at Kahn. He noticed now that Kahn was standing very close to the camera, so close that his features were slightly blurred, out of focus. His face was large and blocked any clear view of the production line behind him.
"You know how I feel, personally," Kahn was saying on the screen.
His face was blocking the line. Sanders watched a moment more and then switched the tape off. "Let's go downstairs," he said.
"You have an idea?"
"Call it a last-ditch hope," he said. The lights clicked on, harsh lights shining on the tables of the diagnostic team. Fernandez said,
"What is this place?"
"This is where they check the drives."
"The drives that don't work?"
"Right." Fernandez gave a little shrug.
"I'm afraid I'm not..."
"Me neither," Sanders said. "I'm not a technical person. I can just read people." She looked around the room.
"Can you read this?"
He sighed.
"No."
Fernandez said,
"Are they finished?"
"I don't know," he said.
and then he saw it. They were finished. They had to be, because otherwise the diagnostics team would be working all night, trying to get ready for the meeting tomorrow. But they had covered the tables up and gone to their professional association meeting because they were finished. The problem was solved. Everybody knew it but him. That was why they had only opened 3 drives. They didn't need to open the others, and they had asked for them to be sealed in plastic. Because? The punctures. Air, he said. Air? They think it's the air. What air? She said. The air in the plant. The plant in Malaysia? Right. This is about air in Malaysia? No, air in the plant. He looked again at the notebook on the table. PPU followed by a row of figures. PPU stood for particulates per unit. It was the standard measure of air cleanliness in a plant. And these figures, ranging from 2 to 11, they were way off. They should be running 0 particulates, 1 at most. These figures were unacceptable. The air in the plant was bad. That meant that they would be getting dirt in the split optics, dirt in the drive arms, dirt in the chip joins. He looked at the chips attached to the board. Christ, he said. What is it? Look. I don't see anything. There's a space between the chips and the boards. The chips aren't seated. It looks okay to me. It's not. He turned to the stacked drives. He could see at a glance that all the chips were seated differently. Some were tight, some had a gap of a few millimeters, so you could see the metal contacts. This isn't right, Sanders said. This should never happen. The fact was that the chips were inserted on the line by automated chip pressers. Every board, every chip should look exactly the same coming off the line. But they didn't. They were all different. Because of that, you could get voltage irregularities, memory allocation problems, all kinds of random stuff. Which was exactly what they were getting. He looked at the blackboard, the list of the flowchart. One item caught his eye. D. Sigma Mechanical. Check, check. The diagnostics team had put 2 checks beside mechanical. The problem with the CD-ROM drives was a mechanical problem, which meant it was a problem in the production line. And the production line was his responsibility. He'd designed it. He'd set it up. He'd checked all the specs on that line from beginning to end. And now it wasn't working right. He was sure that it wasn't his fault. Something must have happened after he had set up the line. Somehow it had been changed around, and it didn't work anymore. But what had happened? To find out, he needed to get onto the databases. But he was locked out. There wasn't any way to get online. Immediately he thought of Bosak. Bosak could get him on. So, for that matter, could one of the programmers on Cherry's teams. These kids were hackers. They would break into a system for a moment of minor amusement, the way ordinary people went out for coffee. But there weren't any programmers in the building now, and he didn't know when they would be back from their meeting. Those kids were so unreliable. Like the kid that had thrown up all over the walker pad. That was the problem. They were just kids, playing with toys like the walker pad. Bright, creative kids, fooling around. No cares at all, and... Oh, Jesus. He sat forward. Louise. Yes? There's a way to do this. Do what? Get into the database. He turned and hurried out of the room. He was rummaging through his pockets, looking for the second electronic pass card. Fernandez said, Are we going somewhere? Yes, we are. Do you mind telling me where? New York, Sanders said. The lights flicked on one after another in long banks. Fernandez stared at the room. What is this? The exercise room from hell? It's a virtual reality simulator, Sanders said. She looked at the round walker pads and all the wires, the cables hanging from the ceiling. This is how you're going to get to New York? That's right. Sanders went over to the hardware cabinets. There were large, hand-painted signs reading, Do not touch, and Hands off, you little wonk. He hesitated, looking for the control console. I hope you know what you're doing, Fernandez said. She stood by one of the walker pads, looking at the silver headset. Because I think somebody could get electrocuted with this.
Yeah, I know.
Sanders lifted covers off monitors and put them back on again, moving quickly. He found the master switch. A moment later, the equipment hummed. One after another, the monitors began to glow. Sanders said, "Get up on the pad." He came over and helped her stand on the walker pad. Fernandez moved her feet experimentally, feeling the balls roll. Immediately, there was a green flash from the lasers.
What was that?
The scanner, mapping you. Don't worry about it. Here's the headset. He brought the headset down from the ceiling and started to place it over her eyes.
Just a minute.
She pulled away.
What is this?
The headset has two small display screens. They project images right in front of your eyes. Put it on, and be careful. These things are expensive.
How expensive?
$250,000 apiece. He fitted the headset over her eyes and put the headphones over her ears.
I don't see any images. It's dark in here.
That's because you're not plugged in, Louise. He plugged in her cables.
Oh,
she said in a surprised voice.
What do you know? I can see a big blue screen, like a movie screen, right in front of me. At the bottom of the screen there are two boxes. One says on, and one says off.
Just don't touch anything. Keep your hands on this bar, he said, putting her fingers on the walker handhold. I'm going to mount up.
This thing on my head feels funny.
Sanders stepped up onto the second walker pad and brought the headset down from the ceiling. He plugged in the cable.
I'll be right with you, he said.
He put on the headset. Sanders saw the blue screen, surrounded by blackness. He looked to his left and saw Fernandez standing beside him. She looked entirely normal, dressed in her street clothes. The video was recording her appearance, and the computer eliminated the walker pad and the headset.
I can see you,
she said in a surprised voice. She smiled. The part of her face covered by the headset was computer animated, giving her a slightly unreal, cartoon-like quality. Walk up to the screen.
How?
Just walk, Louise. Sanders started forward on the walker pad. The blue screen became larger and larger until it filled his field of vision. He went over to the on button and pushed it with his finger. The blue screen flashed. In huge lettering stretching wide in front of them, it said, Digital Communications Data Systems. Beneath that was listed a column of oversized menu items. The screen looked exactly like an ordinary Digicom monitor screen, the kind on everybody's office desk, now blown up to enormous size.
A gigantic computer terminal, Fernandez said.
Wonderful. Just what everybody has been hoping for. Just wait. Sanders poked at the screen, selecting menu items. There was a kind of whoosh, and the lettering on the screen curved inward, pulling back and deepening until it formed a sort of funnel that stretched away from them into the distance. Fernandez was silent. That shut her up, he thought. Now, as they watched, the blue funnel began to distort. It widened, became rectangular. The lettering and the blue color faded. Beneath his feet, a floor emerged. It looked like veined marble. The walls on both sides became wood paneling. The ceiling was white.
It's a corridor, she said, in a soft voice.
The corridor continued to build itself, progressively adding more detail. Drawers and cabinets appeared in the walls. Pillars formed along its length. Other hallways opened up, leading down to other corridors. Large light fixtures emerged from the walls and turned themselves on. Now the pillars cast shadows on the marble floors.
It's like a library, she said. An old-fashioned library.
This part is, yes.
How many parts are there?
I'm not sure. He started walking forward. She hurried to catch up to him. Through his earphones, he heard the sound of their feet clicking on the marble floor. Sherry had added that.
A nice touch.
Fernandez asked,
Have you been here before?
Not for several weeks. Not since it was finished.
Where are we going?
I'm not exactly sure. But somewhere in here there's a way to get into the Conley White database.
She said, Where are we now?
We're in data, Louise. This is all just data.
This corridor is data?
There is no corridor. Everything you see is just a bunch of numbers. It's the Digicom Company database, exactly the same database that people access every day through their computer terminals.
except it's being represented for us as a place.
She walked alongside him.
I wonder who did the decorating.
It's modeled on a real library. In Oxford, I think.
They came to the junction, with other quarters stretching away. Big signs hung overhead. One said, accounting. Another said, human resources. A third said, marketing.
I see, Fernandez said. We're inside your company database.
That's right.
This is amazing.
Yeah, except we don't want to be here. Somehow we have to get into Conley White.
How do we do that?
I don't know, Sanders said. I need help.
Help is here,
said a soft voice nearby. Sanders looked over and saw an angel about a foot high. It was white and hovered in the air near his head. It held a flickering candle in its hands.
Goddamn,
Louise said.
I am sorry, the angel said. Is that a command? I do not recognize goddamn.
No, Sanders said quickly. It's not a command. He was thinking that he would have to be careful or they would crash the system.
Very well. I await your command.
Angel, I need help.
Help is here.
How do I enter the Conley White database?
I do not recognize the Conley White database.
That made sense, Sanders thought. Cherry's team wouldn't have programmed anything about Conley White into the help system. He would have to phrase the question more generally.
Sanders said,
Angel, I am looking for a database.
Very well. Database gateways are accessed with the keypad.
Where's the keypad? Sanders said.
Make a fist with your hand.
Sanders made a fist, and a gray pad formed in the air so that he appeared to be holding it. He pulled it toward him and looked at it.
Pretty neat, Fernandez said. I also know jokes, the angel said. Would you like to hear one?
No, Sanders said.
Very well. I await your command.
Sanders stared at the pad. It had a long list of operator commands with arrows and push buttons. Fernandez said,
What is that, the world's most complicated TV remote?
Just about. He found a push button marked Other DV. That seemed likely. He pressed it. Nothing happened. He pressed it again.
The gateway is opening, the angel announced.
Where? I don't see anything.
The gateway is opening.
Sanders waited. Then he realized that the Digicom system would have to connect to any remote database. The connection was going through. That was causing a delay.
Connecting? Now, the angel said.
The wall of the corridor began to dissolve. They saw a large, gaping black hole and nothing beyond it.
That's creepy,
Fernandez said. White wireframe lines began to appear, outlining a new corridor. The spaces filled, one by one, creating the appearance of solid shapes.
This one looks different, Fernandez said.
We're connecting over a T1 high-speed data line, Sanders said. But even so, it's much slower. The corridor rebuilt itself as they watched. This time the walls were gray. They faced a black and white world.
No color?
The system's trying to generate a simpler environment. Color means more data to push around. So this is black and white. The new corridor added lights, a ceiling, a floor. After a moment, Sanders said, Shall we go in?
You mean the Conley White database is in there?
That's right, Sanders said.
I don't know, she said.
She pointed.
What about this?
Directly in front of them was a kind of flowing river of black and white static. It ran along the floor and also along the walls. It made a loud hissing sound.
I think that's just static off the phone lines. You think it's okay to cross?
We have to. He started forward. Immediately there was a growl. A large dog blocked their path. It had three heads that floated above its body, looking in all directions.
What's that?
Probably a representation of their system security. Cherry and his sense of humor, he thought.
Can it hurt us?
For God's sake, Louise, it's just a cartoon. Somewhere, of course, there was an actual monitoring system running on the Conley White database. Perhaps it was automatic,
or perhaps there was a real person who actually watched users come and go on the system. But now it was nearly 1 o'clock in the morning in New York. The dog was most likely just an automatic device of some kind. Sanders walked forward, stepping through the flowing river of static. The dog growled as he approached. The three heads swiveled, watching him as he passed with cartoon eyes. It was a strange sensation, but nothing happened. He looked back at Fernandez. Coming? She moved forward tentatively. The angel remained behind, hovering in the air. Angel, are you coming? It didn't answer. Probably can't cross a gateway, Sanders said. Not programmed. They walked down the gray corridor. It was lined with unmarked drawers on all sides. It looks like a morgue, Fernandez said. Well, at least we're here. This is their company database in New York? Yes, I just hope we can find it. Find what? He didn't answer her. He walked over to one file cabinet at random and pulled it open. He scanned the folders. Building permits, he said, for some warehouse in Maryland, looks like. Why aren't there labels? Even as she said it, Sanders saw that labels were slowly emerging out of the gray surfaces. I guess it just takes time. Sanders turned and looked in all directions, scanning the other labels. Okay, that's better. HR records are on this wall, over here. He walked along the wall. He pulled open a drawer. Uh-oh, Fernandez said. What? Somebody's coming, she said in an odd voice. At the far end of the corridor, a gray figure was approaching. It was still too distant to make out details, but it was striding directly toward them. What do we do? I don't know, Sanders said. Can he see us? I don't know. I don't think so. We can see him, but he can't see us? I don't know. Sanders was trying to figure it out. Cherry had installed another virtual system in the hotel. If someone was on that system, then he or she could probably see them. But Cherry had said that his system represented other users as well, such as somebody accessing the database from a computer. And somebody using a computer wouldn't be able to see them. The computer user wouldn't know who else was in the system. The figure continued to advance. It seemed to come forward in jerks, not smoothly. They saw more detail. They could start to see eyes, a nose, a mouth. This is really creepy, Fernandez said. The figure was still closer. The details were filling in. No kidding, Sanders said. It was Ed Nichols. Up close, they saw that Nichols's face was represented by a black-and-white photograph wrapped crudely around an egg-shaped head atop a gray moving body that had the appearance of a mannequin or a puppet. It was a computer-generated figure, which meant that Nichols wasn't on the virtual system. He was probably using his notebook computer in his hotel room. Nichols walked up to them and continued steadily past them. He can't see us, Fernandez said. Why does his face look that way? Cherry said that the system pulls a photo from the file and pastes it on users. The Nichols figure continued on walking down the corridor, away from them. What's he doing here? Let's find out. They followed him back down the corridor until Nichols stopped at one file cabinet. He pulled it open and began to go through the records. Sanders and Fernandez came up and stood by his shoulder and watched what he was doing. The computer-generated figure of Ed Nichols was thumbing through his notes and email. He went back 2 months, then 3 months, then 6 months. Now he began to pull out sheets of paper, which seemed to hang in the air as he read them. Memos, notations, personal and confidential, copies to file. Sanders said, "These are all about the acquisition." More notes came out. Nichols was pulling them quickly, one after another. He's looking for something specific. Nichols stopped. He had found what he was looking for. His gray computer image held it in his hand and looked at it. Sanders read it over his shoulder and said certain phrases aloud to Fernandez. Memo dated December 4th last year. Met yesterday and today with Garvin and Johnson in Cupertino. Repossible acquisition of Digicom. Blah, blah. Very favorable first impression.
excellent grounding in critical areas we seek to acquire, blah, blah. Highly capable and aggressive executive staff at all levels. Particularly impressed with competence of Ms. Johnson despite youth. I'll bet you were impressed, Ed. The computer-generated Nichols moved down the hall to another drawer and opened it. He didn't find what he wanted and closed it. He went on to another drawer. Then he began reading again, and Sanders read this one too. Memo to John Martin. Cost issues read Digicom acquisition. Blah, blah. Concern for high technology development costs in new company. Blah, blah. Here we are. Ms. Johnson has undertaken to demonstrate her fiscal responsibility in new Malaysia operation. Suggests savings can be made. Expected cost savings. How the hell could she do that? Do what? Fernandez said. Demonstrate fiscal responsibility in the Malaysia operation. That was my operation. Uh-oh, Fernandez said. You're not going to believe this. Sanders glanced over at her. Fernandez was staring down the corridor. He turned to look. Someone else was coming toward them. Busy night, he said. But even from a distance, he could see that this figure was different. The head was more lifelike, and the body was fully detailed. The figure walked smoothly, naturally. This could be trouble, he said. Sanders recognized him even from a distance. It's John Conley, Fernandez said. Right, and he's on the walker pad. Which means? Conley abruptly stopped in the middle of the corridor and stared. He can see us, Sanders said. He can? How? He's on the system we installed in the hotel. That's why he's so detailed. He's on the other virtual system. So he can see us, and we can see him. Uh-oh. You said it. Conley moved forward slowly. He was frowning. He looked from Sanders to Fernandez to Nichols and back to Sanders. He seemed uncertain what to do. Then he held his finger to his lips, a gesture for silence. Can he hear us? Fernandez whispered. No, Sanders said in a normal voice. Can we talk to him? No. Conley seemed to make a decision. He walked over to Sanders and Fernandez until he was standing very close. He looked from one to the other. They could see his expression perfectly. Then he smiled. He extended his hand. Sanders reached out and shook it. He didn't feel anything, but through the headset he saw what looked like his hand gripping Conley's. Then Conley shook Fernandez's hand. This is extremely weird, Fernandez said. Conley pointed toward Nichols. Then he pointed to his own eyes, then to Nichols again. Sanders nodded. They all went over to stand beside Nichols as he went through the records. You mean Conley's watching him, too? Yes. So we can all see Nichols? Yes. But Nichols can't see any of us? Right. The gray computer figure of Ed Nichols was pulling files hastily out of a drawer. What's he up to now? Sanders said. Ah. Going through expense records. Now he's found one. Sunset Shores Lodge, Carmel, December 5th and 6th, 2 days after his memo. And look at these expenses. $110 for breakfast? Somehow I don't think our Ed was alone there. He looked over at Conley. Conley shook his head, frowning. Suddenly the record Nichols was holding vanished. What happened? I think he just deleted it. Nichols thumbed through other records. He found four more for the Sunset Shores and deleted them all. They vanished in midair. Then he closed the drawer, turned, and walked away. Conley remained behind. He looked at Sanders and drew a finger quickly under his throat. Sanders nodded. Conley again put his finger to his lips. Sanders nodded. He would keep quiet. Come on, Sanders said to Fernandez. We're done in here. He started back toward the Digicom corridor. She walked alongside him, then said, I think we have company. Sanders looked back. Conley was following them. It's okay, he said. Let him come. They crossed the gateway, past the barking dog, and came back into the Victorian library. Fernandez sighed. It feels good to be home again, doesn't it? Conley was walking along, showing no surprise. But then, he had seen the corridor before.
Sanders walked quickly. The angel floated alongside them.
"But you realize," Fernandez said, "that none of this makes any sense, because Nichols is the one who's been opposed to the acquisition, and Conley is the one pushing for it."
"That's right," Sanders said. "It's perfect. Nichols is having it off with Meredith. He promotes her behind the scenes as the new head of the division. And how does he hide that fact? By continuously bitching and moaning to anybody who will listen."
"You mean it's a cover?"
"Sure. That's why Meredith never answered his complaints in any of the meetings. She knew he wasn't a real threat."
"And Conley?" she said.
Conley was still walking alongside them. "Conley genuinely wants the acquisition, and he wants it to work well. Conley's smart, and I think he realizes that Meredith isn't competent for the job. But Conley sees Meredith as the price of Nichols's support, so Conley has gone along with the choice of Meredith, at least for the time being."
"And what are we doing now?"
"Finding out about the last missing piece."
"Which is?"
Sanders was looking down the hallway marked Operations. This wasn't really his area of the database, except in specific places of overlap. The files were marked alphabetically. He went down the row until he found Digicom/Malaysia SA. He opened it up and searched the file section marked Startup. He found his own memos, feasibility studies, site reports, government negotiations, first set specifications, memos from their Singapore suppliers, more government negotiations, all stretching back 2 years.
"What are you looking for?"
"Building plans." He expected to see the thick sheets of blueprints and inspection summaries, but instead there was just a thin file. He opened the first sheet, and a three-dimensional image of the factory floated in the air in front of him. It was just an outline at first, but it rapidly filled in and became solid-looking. Sanders, Fernandez, and Conley stood on three sides of it, looking at it. It was like a very large, detailed doll's house. They peered in through the windows. Sanders pushed a button. The model became transparent, then turned into a cutaway. Now they could see the assembly line, the physical plant. A green line, the conveyor belt, started moving, and the machines and workers assembled the CD-ROM drives as parts came down the line.
"What are you looking for?"
"Revisions." He shook his head. "This is the first set of plans." The second sheet was marked Revisions 1/First Set, with the date. He opened it up. The model of the plant seemed to shimmer for a moment, but it remained the same.
Nothing happened.
The next sheet was marked Revisions 2/Detail Only. Again, when he opened it, the plant shimmered briefly but was unchanged.
"According to these records, the plant was never revised," Sanders said. "But we know it was."
"What's he doing?" Fernandez said. She was looking at Conley. Sanders saw that Conley was slowly mouthing words, his facial movements exaggerated.
"He's trying to tell us something," she said to Sanders. "Can you see what it is?"
"No." Sanders watched a moment, but the cartoon-like quality of Conley's face made it impossible to read his lips. Finally, Sanders shook his head. Conley nodded and took the keypad out of Sanders' hand. He pushed a button marked Related, and Sanders saw a list of related databases flash up in the air. It was an extensive list, including the permits from the Malay government, the architect's notes, the contractor agreements, health and medical inspections, and more. Altogether, there were about 80 items on the list. Sanders felt sure he would have overlooked the one in the middle of the list that Conley was now pointing to. Operations Review Unit.
"What's that?" Fernandez said.
Sanders pressed the name and a new sheet fluttered up. He pushed a button marked Summary and read the sheet aloud. "The Operations Review Unit was formed 4 years ago in Cupertino by Philip Blackburn to address problems not normally within operations management purview. The mission of the review unit was to improve management efficiency within Digicom. Over the years, the operations review unit has successfully resolved a number of management problems at Digicom."
"Uh-huh," Fernandez said.
9 months ago, the operations review unit, then headed by Meredith Johnson of Cupertino Operations,
undertook a review of the proposed manufacturing facility in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. The immediate stimulus for the review was a conflict with the Malay government over the number and ethnic composition of workers employed at the proposed facility.
"Uh-oh," Fernandez said.
Led by Ms. Johnson, with legal assistance from Mr. Blackburn, the Operations Review Unit had outstanding success in resolving the many problems facing Digicom's Malaysian operation.
"What is this, a press release?" Fernandez said.
"Looks like it," Sanders said. He read on. "Specific issues concern the number and ethnic composition of workers employed at the facility. The original plans called for 70 workers to be employed. Responding to the requests of the Malay government, Operations Review was able to increase the number of workers to 85 by reducing the amount of automation at the plant, thus making the facility more suitable to the economy of a developing country." Sanders looked over at Fernandez.
"And screwing us completely," he said.
"Why?" He continued, "In addition, a cost savings review generated important fiscal benefits in a number of areas. Costs were reduced with no detriment to product quality at the plant. Air handling capacity was revised to more appropriate levels, and outsourcing supplier contracts were reallocated with substantial savings benefit to the company." Sanders shook his head.
"That's it," he said. "That's the whole ballgame." "I don't understand," Fernandez said. "This makes sense to you?"
"You're damned right it does." He pushed the detail button for more pages.
"I am sorry," the angel said. "There is no more detail."
"Angel, where are the supporting memos and files?" Sanders knew that there had to be massive paperwork behind these summary changes. The renegotiations with the Malay government alone would fill drawers of files. The angel said,
"I am sorry, there is no more detail available."
"Angel, show me the files."
"Very well."
After a moment, a sheet of pink paper flashed up. "The detail files on Operations Review Unit / Malaysia have been deleted. Sunday, 6:14, authorization DC/C/5905.
"Hell," Sanders said. "What does that mean?"
"Somebody cleaned up," Sanders said. "Just a few days ago. Who knew all this was going to happen?" "Angel, show me all communications between Malaysia and D.C. for the past 2 weeks."
"Do you wish telephone or video links?"
"Video."
"Press V."
He pushed a button and a sheet uncurled in the air. Date 6-1. Linking A. Khan to M. Johnson. Duration 0812 to 0814. Authorization ACSS. Date 6-1. Linking A. Khan to M. Johnson. Duration 1343 to 1346. Authorization ADSS. Date 6-2. Linking A. Khan to M. Johnson. Duration 1801 to 1804. Authorization DCSC. Date 6-2. Linking A. Khan to T. Sanders. Duration 1822 to 1826. Authorization DCSE. Date 6-3. Linking A. Khan to M. Johnson. Duration 0922 to 0924. Authorization ADSC. Date 6-4. Linking A. Khan to M. Johnson. Duration 0902 to 0912. Authorization ADSC. Date 6-5. Linking A. Khan to M. Johnson. Duration 0832 to 0832. Authorization ADSC. Date 6-7. Linking A. Khan to M. Johnson. Duration 0904 to 0905. Authorization ACSS. Date 6-11. Linking A. Khan to M. Johnson. Duration 2002 to 2004. Authorization ADSC. Date 6-13. Linking A. Khan to M. Johnson. Duration 0902
to 0932. Authorization ADSC. Date 614, linking A. Khan to M. Johnson. Duration 1124 to 1125. Authorization ACSS. Date 615, linking A. Khan to T. Sanders. Duration 1132 to 1134. Authorization DCSE.
Burning up the satellite links, Sanders said, staring at the list. Arthur Khan and Meredith Johnson talked almost every day until June 14th. Angel, show me these video links.
The links are not available for viewing except for 6:15.
This had been his own transmission to Khan 2 days earlier.
Where are the others?
A message flashed up. The video files on Operations Review Unit / Malaysia have been deleted. Sunday, 6:14, authorization DC/C/5905. Scrubbed again. He was pretty sure who had done it, but he had to be sure.
Angel, how do I check deletion authorization?
Press the data you desire, the angel said.
Sanders pressed the authorization number. A small sheet of paper came upward out of the top sheet and hung in the air.
Authorization DC/C/5905 is Digital Communications Cupertino/Operations Executive. Special privileges noted. No operator ID necessary.
It was done by somebody very high up in operations in Cupertino a few days ago.
Meredith?
Probably, and it means I'm screwed.
Why?
Because now I know what was done at the Malaysia plant. I know exactly what happened. Meredith went in and changed the specs, but she's erased the data right down to her voice transmissions to Khan, which means I can't prove any of it.
Standing in the corridor, Sanders poked the sheet, and it fluttered back down, dissolving into the top sheet.
He closed his file, put it back in the drawer, and watched the model dissolve and disappear. He looked over at Conley. Conley gave a little resigned shrug. He seemed to understand the situation. Sanders shook his hand, gripping air, and waved goodbye. Conley nodded and turned to leave.
Now what?
Fernandez said.
It's time to go, Sanders said.
The angel began to sing. It's time to go, so long again, till next week's show.
Angel, be quiet.
The angel stopped singing. He shook his head.
Just like Don Cherry.
Who's Don Cherry? Fernandez asked.
Don Cherry is a living god, the angel said.
They walked back to the entrance to the corridor and then climbed out of the blue screen.
Back in Cherry's lab, Sanders took off the headset and, after a moment of disorientation, stepped off the walker pad. He helped Fernandez remove her equipment.
Oh, she said, looking around. We're back in the real world.
If that's what you call it, he said, I'm not sure it's that much more real.
He hung up her headset and helped her down from the walker pad. Then he turned off the power switches around the room.
Fernandez yawned and looked at her watch.
It's 11 o'clock. What are you going to do now? There was only one thing he could think of.
He picked up the receiver on one of Cherry's data modem lines and dialed Gary Bosak's number. Sanders couldn't retrieve any data, but perhaps Bosak could, if he could talk him into it. It wasn't much of a hope, but it was all he could think to do.
An answering machine said,
Hi, this is NE Professional Services. I'm out of town for a few days, but leave a message.
And then a beep.
Sanders sighed.
Gary, it's 11 o'clock on Wednesday. I'm sorry I missed you. I'm going home.
He hung up.
His last hope. Gone. Out of town for a few days.
Shit, he said.
Now what? Fernandez said, yawning.
I don't know, he said. I've got half an hour to make the last ferry. I guess I'll go home and try to get some sleep.
And the meeting tomorrow? She asked.
You said you need documentation.
Sanders shrugged.
Louise, I've done all that I can do. I know what I'm up against. I'll manage somehow.
Then I'll see you tomorrow?
Yeah, he said. See you tomorrow.
He felt less sanguine on the ferry going home, looking back at the lights of the city and the rippling black water. Fernandez was right. He ought to be getting the documentation he needed. Max would criticize him if he knew. He could almost hear the old man's voice.
"Oh, so you're tired? That's a good reason, Thomas."
He wondered if Max would be at the meeting tomorrow, but he found he couldn't really think about it. He couldn't imagine the meeting. He was too tired to concentrate. The loudspeaker announced that they were 5 minutes from Winslow, and he went below decks to get into his car. He unlocked the door and slipped behind the wheel. He looked in the rearview mirror and saw a dark silhouette in the back seat.
"Hey," Gary Bosack said.
Sanders started to turn.
"Just keep looking forward," Bosack said. "I'll get out in a minute. Now listen carefully. They're going to screw you tomorrow. They're going to pin the Malaysia fiasco on you."
"I know. And if that doesn't work, they're going to hit you with employing me. Invasion of privacy, felonious activity, all that crap. They've talked to my parole officer. Maybe you've seen him, a fat guy with a mustache?"
Sanders vaguely remembered the man walking up to the mediation center the day before.
"I think so, yes."
"Gary, listen, I need some documents."
"Don't talk, there's no time. They pulled all the documents relating to the plant off the system. Nothing's there anymore. It's gone. I can't help you."
They heard the sound of the ferry horn. All around them, drivers were starting their engines.
"But I'm not going down for this felony crap, and you're not either. Take this."
He reached forward and handed Sanders an envelope.
"What's this?"
"Summary of some work I did for another officer of your company. Garvin, you might want to fax it to him in the morning."
"Why don't you?"
"I'm crossing the border tonight. I have a cousin in B.C. I'll stay there for a while. You can leave a message on my machine if it turns out okay."
"All right.
Stay cool, guy. The shit's really going to hit the fan tomorrow. Lots of changes coming."
Up ahead, the ramp went down with a metallic clang. The traffic officers were directing cars off the ferry.
"Gary, you've been monitoring me?"
"Yeah, sorry about that. They told me I had to."
"Then who's a friend?"
Bosack laughed. He opened the door and got out.
"I'm surprised at you, Tom. Don't you know who your friends are?"
The cars were beginning to pull out. Sanders saw brake lights on the car ahead of him flash red, and the car began to move.
"Gary," he said, turning.
But Bosack was gone. He put the car in gear and drove off the ferry. At the top of the driveway, he stopped to pick up his mail. There was a lot of it. He hadn't checked the mailbox for 2 days. He drove down to the house and left the car outside the garage. He unlocked the front door and went in. The house seemed empty and cold. It had a lemony odor. Then he remembered that Consuela had probably cleaned up. He went into the kitchen and set up the coffee maker for the morning. The kitchen was clean and the children's toys had been picked up. Consuela had definitely been there. He looked at the answering machine. A red numeral was blinking. 14. Sanders replayed the calls. The first was from John Levin, asking him to call, saying it was urgent. Then Sally, asking if the kids could arrange a play date. But the rest were all hang-ups, and as he listened, they all seemed to sound exactly the same. The thin, hissing background static of an overseas call, and then the abrupt click of disconnection, again and again. Someone was trying to call him. One of the later calls was apparently placed by an operator, because a woman's lilting voice said, "I'm sorry, there is no answer. Do you wish to leave a message?" And then a man's voice replied, "No," and then disconnection. Sanders played it back, listening to that "no." He thought it sounded familiar. Foreign, but still familiar. "No." He listened several times, but could not identify the speaker. "No." One time he thought the man sounded hesitant. Or was it hurried? He couldn't tell. "Do you wish to leave a message?" "No." Finally, he gave up, rewound the machine, and went upstairs to his office. He'd had no faxes. His computer screen was blank. No further help from a friend tonight. He read through the paper that Bosack had given him in the car. It was a single sheet, a memo addressed to Garvin, containing a report summary on a Cupertino employee whose name was blanked out. There was also a Xerox of a check made out to N.E. Professional Services, signed by Garvin.
It was after 1 when Sanders went into the bathroom and took a shower. He turned the water up hot, held his face close to the nozzle, and felt the stinging spray on his skin. With the sound of the shower roaring in his ears, he almost missed hearing the telephone ringing. He grabbed a towel and ran into the bedroom. "Hello?" He heard the static hiss of an overseas connection. A man's voice said, "Mr. Sanders, please." "This is Mr. Sanders speaking." "Mr. Sanders, sir," the voice said. "I do not know if you will remember me. This is Muhammad Jafar." Thursday. The morning was clear. Sanders took an early ferry to work and got to his office at 8. He passed the downstairs receptionist and saw a sign that said, "Main conference room in use." For a horrified moment, he thought that he had again mistaken the time for his meeting and hurried to look in. But it was Garvin addressing the Conley White executives. Garvin was speaking calmly, and the executives were nodding as they listened. Then, as he watched, Garvin finished and introduced Stephanie Kaplan, who immediately launched into a financial review with slides. Garvin left the conference room, and immediately his expression turned grim as he walked down the hallway toward the espresso bar at the end of the corridor, ignoring Sanders. Sanders was about to head upstairs when he heard Phil Blackburn say, "I really feel I have a right to protest the way this matter has been handled." "Well, you don't," Garvin said angrily. "You don't have any rights at all." Sanders moved forward toward the espresso bar. From his position across the hallway, he was able to see into the bar. Blackburn and Garvin were talking by the coffee machines.
"But this is extremely unfair," Blackburn said.
"Fuck unfair," Garvin said. "She named you as the source, you stupid asshole."
"But, Bob, you told me..."
"I told you what?" Garvin said, eyes narrowing.
"You told me to handle it, to put pressure on Sanders."
"That's right, Phil. And you told me that you were going to take care of it."
"But you knew I talked to..."
"I knew you had done something," Garvin said, "but I didn't know what. Now she's named you as a source." Blackburn hung his head.
"I just think it's extremely unfair."
"Really? But what do you expect me to do? You're the fucking lawyer, Phil. You're the one always sweating about how things look. You tell me, what do I do?"
Blackburn was silent for a moment. Finally, he said, "I'll get John Robinson to represent me. He can work out the settlement agreement."
"Okay, fine." Garvin nodded. "That's fine.
But I just want to say to you, on a personal level, Bob, that I feel my treatment in this matter has been very unfair."
"God damn it, Phil, don't talk to me about your feelings. Your feelings are for sale. Now listen with both ears. Don't go upstairs. Don't clean out your desk. Go right to the airport. I want you on a plane in the next half hour. I want you fucking out of here right now. Is that clear?"
"I just think you should acknowledge my contribution to the company."
"I am, you asshole," Garvin said. "Now get the fuck out of here before I lose my temper."
Sanders turned and hurried upstairs. It was hard for him to keep from cheering. Blackburn was fired. He wondered if he should tell anybody. Perhaps Cindy, he thought. But when he got to the fourth floor, the hallways were buzzing. Everyone was out of their offices, talking in the corridors. Obviously, rumors of the firing had already leaked. Sanders was not surprised that staffers were in the hallways. Even though Blackburn was disliked, his firing would cause widespread uneasiness. Such a sudden change, involving a person so close to Garvin, conveyed to everyone a sense of peril. Everything was at risk. Outside his office, Cindy said,
"Tom, can you believe it? They say Garvin is going to fire Phil."
"You're kidding," Sanders said.
Cindy nodded. "Nobody knows why, but apparently it had something to do with a news crew last night. Garvin's been downstairs explaining it to the Conley White people."
Behind him, somebody shouted, "It's on the email." The hallway was instantly deserted. Everyone vanished into their offices. Sanders stepped behind his desk and clicked the email icon. But it was slow coming up, probably because every employee in the building was clicking at exactly the same time.
Fernandez came in and said, "Is it true about Blackburn?"
"I guess so," Sanders said. "It's just coming over the email now."
From Robert Garvin, President and CEO, to all the Digicom family.
It is with great sadness and a deep sense of personal loss that I today announce the resignation of our valued and trusted Chief Corporate Counsel, Philip A. Blackburn. Phil has been an outstanding officer of this company for nearly 15 years, a wonderful human being, and a close personal friend and advisor as well. I know that, like me, many of you will miss his wise counsel and good humor profoundly in the days and weeks to come. And I am sure that you will all join me in wishing him the best of good fortune in his new endeavors. A hearty thank you, Phil, and good luck. This resignation is effective immediately. Howard Eberhardt will serve as acting counsel until such time as a new permanent appointment is made. Robert Garvin. Fernandez said, "What does it say?" "It says I fired his sanctimonious ass." "It had to happen," Fernandez said, "especially since he was the source on the Connie Walsh story." Sanders said, "How did you know that?" "Eleanor Breeze."
"She told you?"
"No, but Eleanor Breeze is a very cautious attorney. All those media attorneys are. The safest way to keep your job is to refuse to let things run. When in doubt, throw it out. So I had to ask myself, why did she let the Mr. Piggy story run when it's clearly defamatory? The only possible reason is that she felt Walsh had an unusually strong source inside the company, a source that understood the legal implications, a source that, in giving the story, was in essence also saying, we won't sue if you print it. Since high-ranking corporate officers never know anything about law, it means the source could only be a high-ranking lawyer.
Phil.
Yes.
Jesus.
Does this change your plans? Fernandez said. Sanders had been considering that.
I don't think so, he said. I think Garvin would have fired him later in the day anyway.
You sound confident.
Yeah, I got some ammunition last night, and I hope more today.
Cindy came in and said, Are you expecting something from KL, a big file?
Yes.
This one's been coming in since 7 a.m. It must be a monster.
She put a DAT cartridge on his desk. It was exactly like the DAT cartridge that had recorded his video link with Arthur Kahn.
Fernandez looked at him. He shrugged.
At 8:30, he transmitted Bosak's memo to Garvin's private fax machine. Then he asked Cindy to make copies of all the faxes that Muhammad Jafar had sent him the previous night. Sanders had been up most of the night reading the material that Jafar had sent him, and it made interesting reading. Jafar, of course, was not ill. He had never been ill. That had been a little story that Kahn had contrived with Meredith. He pushed the DAT video cassette into the machine and turned to Fernandez.
You going to explain? She said.
I hope it'll be self-explanatory, Sanders said.
On the monitor, the following appeared. 5 seconds to direct video link up. DC/M-DC/C. Sender, A. Kahn. Receiver, M. Johnson. On the screen, he saw Kahn at the factory, and then a moment later the screen split and he saw Meredith at her office in Cupertino.
What is this? Fernandez said. A recorded video communication from last Sunday.
I thought the communications were all erased.
They were, here. But there was still a record in KL. A friend of mine sent it to me.
On the screen, Arthur Kahn coughed.
Meredith, I'm a little concerned.
Don't be, Meredith said.
But we still aren't able to manufacture to specs. We have to replace the air handlers, at the very least. Put in better ones.
Not now.
But we have to, Meredith.
Not yet.
But those handlers are inadequate, Meredith. We both thought they'd be okay, but they aren't.
Never mind.
Kahn was sweating. He rubbed his chin nervously. It's only a matter of time before Tom figures it out, Meredith. He's not stupid, you know.
He'll be distracted.
So you say.
And besides, he's going to quit.
Kahn looked startled. He is? I don't think he...
Trust me, he'll quit. He's going to hate working for me. Sitting in Sanders' office, Fernandez leaned forward, staring at the screen. She said, No shit.
Kahn said, Why will he hate it?
Meredith said, "Believe me, he will. Tom Sanders will be out in my first 48 hours."
"But how can you be sure?"
"What choice does he have? Tom and I have a history. Everybody in the company knows that. If any problem comes up, nobody will believe him. He's smart enough to understand that. If he ever wants to work again, he'll have no choice but to take whatever settlement he's offered and leave."
Khan nodded, wiping the sweat from his cheek.
"And then we say Sanders made the changes at the plant? He'll deny that he did."
"He won't even know. Remember, he'll be gone by then, Arthur."
"And if he isn't?"
"Trust me, he'll be gone. He's married, has a family. He'll go."
"But if he calls me about the production line?"
"Just evade it, Arthur. Be mystified. You can do that, I'm sure. Now, who else does Sanders talk to there?"
"The foreman, sometimes. Jafar. Jafar knows everything, of course. And he's one of those honest sorts. I'm afraid if..."
"Make him take a vacation."
"He just took one."
"Make him take another, Arthur. I only need a week here."
"Jesus," Khan said. "I'm not sure."
She cut in. "Arthur."
"Yes, Meredith?"
"This is the time when a new vice president counts favors that will be repaid in the future."
"Yes, Meredith."
"That's all."
The screen went blank. There were white streaking video lines, and then the screen was dark.
"Pretty cut and dried," Fernandez said.
Sanders nodded.
Meredith didn't think the changes would matter because she didn't know anything about production. She was just cutting costs. But she knew that the changes at the plant would eventually be traced back to her, so she thought she had a way to get rid of me, to make me quit the company, and then she would be able to blame me for the problems at the plant.
And Khan went along with it.
Sanders nodded.
And they got rid of Jafar.
Sanders nodded.
Khan told Jafar to go visit his cousin in Johor for a week, to get out of town, to make it impossible for me to reach Jafar. But he never thought that Jafar would call me. He glanced at his watch.
"Now, where is it?"
"What?"
On the screen, there was a series of tones, and they saw a handsome, dark-skinned newscaster at a desk, facing a camera and speaking rapidly in a foreign language.
"What's this?" Fernandez said.
"The Channel 3 Evening News from last December."
Sanders got up and pushed a button on the tape machine. The cassette popped out.
"What does it show?"
Cindy came back from the copying machine with wide eyes. She carried a dozen stacks of paper, each neatly clipped.
"What are you going to do with this?"
"Don't worry about it," he said.
"But this is outrageous, Tom, what she's done."
"I know," he said.
"Everybody is talking," she said. "The word is the merger is off."
"We'll see," Sanders said.
With Cindy's help, he began arranging the piles of paper in identical manila folders.
Fernandez said,
"What exactly are you going to do?"
"Meredith's problem is that she lies," Sanders said. "She's smooth, and she gets away with it. She's gotten away with it her whole life. I'm going to see if I can get her to make a single, very big lie."
He looked at his watch. It was 8:45. The meeting would start in 15 minutes.
The conference room was packed. There were 15 Conley White executives down one side of the table, with John Martin in the middle, and 15 Digicom executives down the other side, with Garvin in the middle. Meredith Johnson stood at the head of the table and said,
"Next, we'll hear from Tom Sanders. Tom, I wonder if you could review for us where we stand with the Twinkle Drive. What is the status of our production there?"
"Of course, Meredith." Sanders stood, his heart pounding. He walked to the front of the room. "By way of background, Twinkle is our code name for a standalone CD-ROM drive player, which we expect to be revolutionary." He turned to the first of his charts. CD-ROM is a small laser disc used to store data. It is cheap to manufacture and can hold an enormous amount of information in any form. Words, images, sound, video, and so on. You can put the equivalent of 600 books on a single small disc. Or thanks to our research here, an hour and a half of video. And any combination. For example, you could make a textbook that combines text, pictures,
short movie sequences, animated cartoons, and so on. Production costs will soon be at 10 cents a unit. He looked down the table. The Conley white people were interested. Garvin was frowning. Meredith looked tense. But for CD-ROM to be effective, two things need to happen. First, we need a portable player, like this. He held up the player, and then passed it down the Conley white side. A 5-hour battery, and an excellent screen. You can use it on a train, a bus, or in a classroom, anywhere you can use a book. The executives looked at it, turned it over in their hands. Then they looked back at Sanders. The other problem with CD-ROM technology, Sanders said, is that it's slow. It's sluggish getting to all that wonderful data. But the Twinkle drives that we have successfully made in prototype are twice as fast as any other drive in the world. And with added memory for our packing and unpacking images, it is as quick as a small computer. We expect to get the unit cost for these drives down to the price of a video game unit within a year. And we are manufacturing the drives now. We have had some early problems, but we are solving them. Meredith said,
"Can you tell us more about that? I gather from talking to Arthur Kahn that we're still not clear on why the drives have problems."
"Actually, we are," Sanders said. "It turns out that the problems aren't serious at all. I expect them to be entirely resolved in a matter of days."
"Really?"
She raised her eyebrows. "Then we've found what the trouble is?"
"Yes, we have." "That's wonderful news."
"Yes, it is." "Very good news indeed," Ed Nichols said. "Was it a design problem?"
"No," Sanders said. "There's nothing wrong with the design we made here, just as there was nothing wrong with the prototypes. What we have is a fabrication problem involving the production line in Malaysia."
"What sort of problems?"
"It turns out," Sanders said, "that we don't have the proper equipment on the line. We should be using automatic chip installers to lock the controller chips and the RAM cache on the board, but the Malays on the line have been installing chips by hand, literally pushing them in with their thumbs. And it turns out that the assembly line is dirty, so we're getting particulate matter in the split optics. We should have level 7 air handlers, but we only have level 5 handlers installed. And it turns out that we should be ordering components like hinge rods and clips from one very reliable Singapore supplier, but the components are actually coming from another supplier. Less expensive, less reliable."
Meredith looked uneasy, but only for a moment.
"Improper equipment? Improper conditions? Improper components?"
She shook her head.
"I'm sorry. Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't you set up that line, Tom?"
"Yes, I did," Sanders said. "I went out to Kuala Lumpur last fall and set it up with Arthur Kahn and the local foreman, Muhammad Jafar."
"Then how is it that we have so many problems?"
"Unfortunately, there was a series of bad judgment calls in setting up the line."
Meredith looked concerned. "Tom, we all know that you're extremely competent. How could this have happened?"
Sanders hesitated.
This was the moment.
"It happened because the line was changed," he said. "The specifications were altered."
"Altered? How?"
"I think that's something for you to explain to this group, Meredith," he said, "since you ordered the changes."
"I ordered them?"
"That's right, Meredith."
"Tom, you must be mistaken," she said coolly. "I haven't had anything to do with that Malaysia line."
"Actually, you have," Sanders said. "You made 2 trips there in November and December of last year."
2 trips to Kuala Lumpur, yes. But you mishandled a labor dispute with the Malaysian government. I went there and resolved the dispute, but I had nothing to do with the actual production line."
"I'd say you're mistaken, Meredith."
"I assure you," she said coldly, "I am not. I had nothing to do with the line and any so-called changes."
"Actually, you went there and inspected the changes you ordered."
"I'm sorry, Tom. I didn't. I've never even seen the actual line."
On the screen behind her, the videotape of the newscast began to play silently with the sound off, the newscaster in coat and tie speaking to the camera.
Sanders said, "You never went to the plant itself?"
"Absolutely not, Tom. I don't know who could have told you such a thing, or why you would say it now."
The screen behind the newscaster showed the Digicom building in Malaysia, then the interior of the plant. The camera showed the production lines and an official inspection tour taking place. They saw Phil Blackburn, and alongside him, Meredith Johnson. The camera moved in on her as she chatted with one of the workers. There was a murmur in the room. Meredith spun around and looked.
"This is outrageous. This is out of context. I don't know where this could have come from."
Malaysia, Channel 3, their version of the BBC.
"I'm sorry, Meredith."
The newscast segment finished and the screen went blank. Sanders made a gesture and Cindy began moving around the table, handing a manila folder to each person. Meredith said,
"Wherever this so-called tape came from..."
Sanders said, "Ladies and gentlemen, if you will open your packets, you will find the first of a series of memos from the Operations Review Unit, which was under the direction of Ms. Johnson in the period in question. I direct your attention to the first memo, dated November 18th of last year. You will notice that it has been signed by Meredith Johnson, and it stipulates that the line will be changed to accommodate the labor demands of the Malay government. In particular, this first memo states that automated chip installers will not be included, but that this work will be done by hand. That made the Malay government happy, but it meant we couldn't manufacture the drives."
Johnson said, "But you see, what you are overlooking is that the Malays gave us no choice."
"In that case, we should never have built the plant there," Sanders said, cutting her off, "because we can't manufacture the intended product at those revised specifications. The tolerances are inadequate."
Johnson said, "Well, that may be your own opinion."
The second memo, dated December 3rd, indicates that a cost savings review diminished air handling capacities on the line. Again, this is a variance in the specifications that I established.
Again, it is critical. We can't manufacture high-performance drives under these conditions.
The long and the short of it is that these decisions doomed the drives to failure.
"Now look," Johnson said, "if anybody believes that the failure of these drives is anything but your..."
The third memo, Sanders said, summarizes cost savings from the Operations Review Unit. You'll see that it claims an 11% reduction in operating costs. That savings has already been wiped out by fabrication delays, not counting our time-to-market delay costs. Even if we immediately restore the line, this 11% savings translates into a production cost increase over the run of nearly 70%. First year, it's a 190% increase. End of Side 8. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.